Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Ben Baldanza, really I am. Regular listeners will notice that my voice is back to something close to what it used to be. In the aircraft world, we would call this the Ben NVO new voice option, or maybe the Ben Max, same body with new engines. I'm excited to fly with the improved voice, Scott McCartney. What do you think?
Ben, I think Ben NVO is absolutely wonderful and very exciting. I think listeners are going to enjoy hearing even more from you and enjoying much more of your great wit and wisdom. And the new voice option comes without any kind of fee charged to listeners. That's not very Baldanza, is it? Please explain what's going on.
Better service without a fee. That just means all of our listeners have elite status on Airlines Confidential. Airlines install big bins. We've installed a bigger voice. Let me explain. I've been working with a company called 11 Labs on an artificial intelligence version of my voice. There are 14 people in this company, and I owe them a huge debt of gratitude for what they've done. Because we have the library of Airlines Confidential podcasts, there's a lot of hours of my voice available. So we are going to give this a try. Listeners know that the disease ALS has weakened my voice. I may jump in from time to time with my normal voice, but I think AI Ben sounds better, and with that, I can contribute more to the podcast. I'm very excited to test this out, and I hope listeners will let us know what they think.
I think this is fantastic, Ben, and truly one of the great uses of AI technology. We hear so much about nefarious stuff and the AI possibilities of impersonating and appropriating someone's voice and literally putting words in their mouth. This is the flip side, the great use of AI that has given you much more ability to speak up and speak out. These aren't AI comments and answers. We're not asking the computer to answer for you or to guess how Ben might answer. We're just asking the computer to voice the words you type. Kudos to you for being brave enough to take the plunge, and congratulations to the whole team that put Ben Max together. I trust the quality in Ben Max is better than Boeing's Max. And please, listeners, let us know what you think. Go to airlinesconfidential.com and click on Contact Us. Another voice I'm excited to hear is Doug Parker's. The former chairman and CEO of American Airlines is back with us this week. Doug has an important aviation issue he wants to talk about, and we love to check in from time to time with Doug, because he can smartly decode issues and trends and offers great insight that I think we can all learn from. Nobody better than Doug to talk about the latest aviation merger, AI, and Ben's voice. Okay, besides AI Ben, there is a lot of news this week. Maybe none of it as big as the launch of AI Ben. Let's start with the formal breakup of JetBlue and Spirit. The two airlines agreed to terminate their merger agreement, with JetBlue paying Spirit $69 million. The agreement was due to expire in July, but the two airlines agreed to the earlier termination to get on with whatever is next for each of them independently. For JetBlue, it's unclear how it can gain the girth it needs to compete against an oligopoly. The government says it can't align with American in the Northeast. It can't merge with a discount airline. Growing organically 5 or 7% a year probably isn't going to do it. In fact, JetBlue may not grow at all this year. The carrier forecasts lower capacity this year, with as many as 15 airplanes grounded by Pratt & Whitney engine inspections and repairs. And that's probably a blessing, because it needs to restore profitability. For Spirit, the crisis is immediate, and freeing Spirit for its next moves before July seems like the driver behind this termination agreement. Spirit needs to refinance more than $1 billion in debt that comes due next year, not to mention needs to find a way to get back to profitability. So stay tuned. Will Frontier come in with a lowball offer since Spirit is worth a whole lot less than it was 2 years ago and is in a much weaker position? Or will Frontier wait for a bankruptcy fire sale? You can get the assets without much of the debt in a bankruptcy auction. Or maybe there's a prepackaged reorganization plan with new capital from Frontier or maybe from a private equity buyer. I do think the termination coming 4 months early means that Spirit is feeling the pressure to do something quickly.
Well, even with my new voice, I can't comment on JetBlue's plan, Scott. I will say that the government messed this up because it leaves Spirit in a precarious place. And I will say that I think JetBlue has a very strong market position in the Northeast and Florida, and it's a great company with great leadership. It will figure this out. Here's some news that is not only important to me, but also important to airlines and to travelers. The Department of Transportation proposed new rules for handling wheelchairs and new penalties for mishandling wheelchairs. If it goes through, it would be the biggest expansion of protections for wheelchair passengers in 15 years. The proposed rule would make mishandling a wheelchair an automatic violation of the Air Carrier Access Act, which means DOT could speed up enforcement and penalties on airlines. It lays out requirements for fixing or paying for repairs on wheelchairs and would require airlines to provide a loaner while repairs are made. It would require additional training for airline workers and would set some standards for prompt assistance to people with disabilities at airports and getting on and off planes. The DOT says an estimated 5.5 million Americans use a wheelchair, and many encounter barriers when it comes to air travel. In 2023, 11,500 wheelchairs and scooters were mishandled by carriers, which are required to report wheelchair data to DOT. I think more focus on wheelchair travel is a good thing. It's tough. I find a lot of very good attentive service and also some big barriers. The real challenge is that some unscrupulous travelers use this service to board and then walk off at the other end. One airline COO once told me that if only people who really needed wheelchairs used this service, it would be no problem for the industry.
That's really fascinating. You do see those miracle cures all the time. I did a story on it once at LAX because it was just rampant there. People realized they could jump to the front of the TSA line and get through quickly and then go running off. I also wrote about how much damage there is to wheelchairs and how critical this is for wheelchair users to arrive somewhere on a trip and have your chair damaged to the point that you're stuck, you're immobile. It's horrifying. And it at the same time, it's a very difficult problem for airlines. These things are heavy. They can be fragile. I came away from that really thinking, hey, the wheelchair industry needs to develop a tough, sturdy travel wheelchair that will work for people. And the airline industry needs to get a whole lot better and invest in the equipment that handlers need to properly both get these things off jet bridges and back up jet bridges at destinations and also store them properly in the belly of airplanes. So in other news, Ben, Delta did the expected. It raised baggage fees by $5 to $35 for the first checked bag and $45 for the second checked bag. American and United are the same if you prepay for the first bag, but if you show up at the airport, you'll pay $40 for that first bag on American and United. Interestingly, this is a price hike that will show up in inflation data. The Consumer Price Index surveys airfares, and I didn't know this. It also assumes that 76% of the quotes in the CPI sample will include first checked baggage fees. On first glance, 76% seems high to me. That might be the overall percentage of people who check bags, but even that seems kind of high to me. Factor in those with elite status and credit card benefits, and I bet the percentage who actually are paying the fees is lower. Then again, U.S. airlines are collecting some $7 billion a year in baggage fees, so a whole lot of people really are paying them. And 76% doesn't seem like an arbitrary number, right? Some data went into this. Bottom line, the bag fee increases will drive inflation higher. But speaking of airfare, here's my rant of the week, Ben. I heard Timothy Wu, the Columbia University law professor credited with driving a lot of the Biden administration antitrust approach, on CNBC recently, and he made two crucial factual errors. We've talked about Wu before, and Dorothy Robine has been on the show taking issue with some of his antitrust airline competition pronouncements, such as his New York Times op-ed piece that argued the bigger airlines become, the worse they get. On CNBC, and shame on CNBC for not calling him out on this, he said airfares were higher. They are not, according to the government's own data. 20 years ago, the average domestic ticket cost $312. That's for the third quarter of 2003, because the latest DOT data is for the third quarter of 2023. In that third quarter of 2023, the average domestic fare was $368. But adjusted for inflation, the 20-year-old fare would have been $519, 41% higher, not lower. Yes, fares are higher, but that's only if you don't account for inflation, and that's not fair. Let's look further. 10 years ago, the average fare, adjusted for inflation, was $501. 5 years ago, it was $418. 2 years ago, it was $352, lower than what it is today. 1 year ago, it was $396, higher than today. So the only period when the average fare was lower than $368 was the third quarter of 2021, when we were coming out of the pandemic. I looked too at the CPI data on airfares just to make sure it doesn't disagree with the DOT airfare data. They're different. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does a sampling each month of fares. The DOT data is based on a 10% sample that airlines give DOT, its actual tickets. BLS goes shopping each month for the cheapest prices in the marketplace, but it doesn't necessarily reflect what people are actually buying. And in January 2024, the average in the fare basket was $248. A year earlier, it was $265. Fares were 6% lower than a year ago. That holds. True, fares were lower in January 2021 and January 2022 than they are now. But that's it in recent history. Fares in January in the CPI survey were higher every year from 2014 to 2020. And by the way, they declined each year in January from 2014 to 2019. They increased a bit in January 2020 compared to a year earlier, but then came the pandemic. Bottom line, yes, airfares are higher compared to the pandemic, but that's it. Otherwise, they are lower. Over a long period of time, they are lower. Over a short period of time, 1 year ago, they are lower. To say airfares are higher is dishonest and just plain wrong. The other falsehood Wu stated was that Spirit was, quote, slightly profitable, quote. The context was Wu suggested that Spirit would find its way through the world on its own just fine without JetBlue. CNBC pressed him on whether the Justice Department had really helped competition if Spirit ends up in bankruptcy, reorganization, or liquidation. I'd like to know when Spirit was, quote, slightly profitable, because it wasn't during any period of the Biden administration. In the fourth quarter of last year, Spirit had an operating loss of $215 million and a net loss of $184. For the full year last year, it was an operating loss of $496 million and a net loss of $447 million. There's no slightly profitable to be found anywhere there. In fact, the last time Spirit was slightly profitable was 2019, before the pandemic saddled it with enormous debt and before the Big Four really were exercising their market dominance. Good policy requires good facts. If you can't get your facts straight, you shouldn't be making policy. End of my rant for this week, Ben.
Thanks for fact-checking all of this, Scott. 76% checking bags seems a bit high to me. When Spirit first charged for check bags, that number was 70% on Spirit. And being an all-leisure and family airline, that should be higher than airlines with plenty of briefcase-carrying business travelers. Fares are down in part because of fewer business travelers. Without those high fares added to the mix, the average shrinks. On Spirit being slightly profitable, I agree he was way off. Now, anyone can look at an income statement or balance sheet and find some good news, so I bet he was cherry-picking a bit.
Yeah, I think that must be right. You're giving him the benefit of the doubt, Ben. Well, Airlines Confidential wouldn't exist without our sponsors. We want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offers, services, and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
We want to thank Cirium, which offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies, enables you to predict market shifts, and help airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunity. Visit Cirium.com for more.
And we want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology. And by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they're committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at PrattWhitney.com.
Let's now bring in Doug Parker and hear what's on his mind.
Doug Parker is the former chief executive officer of American Airlines Group. He remade the U.S. airline industry by leading the merger of America West into U.S. Airways and then U.S. Airways into American. He became the CEO of America West just 10 days before the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, and led the struggling carrier through the crisis. Doug started out at American and, as listeners know, worked with Ben years back. After American, he went to Northwest and then on to America West. Doug and his wife, Gwen, have launched a nonprofit called Breaking Down Barriers to create a pipeline for pilot training from underserved communities. He's been a guest before on Airlines Confidential, and we are delighted to have you back, Doug.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Scott. Thank you, Ben.
So you were involved in the creation of TSA after 9/11 and rules like locked cockpit doors, no liquids in large quantities, ID checks, no fly lists, etc. All that's led to years of safe airline travel. But you're fired up now about what you see as a deficiency in aviation security and one that you think the government is ignoring. Explain what's going on.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I am a little fired up. Look, the issue is we have, unfortunately, now our government has allowed airlines that fly scheduled service, but they don't have TSA security checks in place for their passengers. And frankly, I think this is a national disaster just waiting to happen. And it does feel, hopefully not being ignored, but certainly being not as urgently addressed as I think it should be. So anyway, just a couple of stories. These, what I think most of us now refer to as scheduled charters. And for the record, I have no issue with the operators of these scheduled charters themselves. I mean, you could argue perhaps they're being somewhat irresponsible, but you know, they're reliant upon the regulators to tell them what they need to do to be safe. And the regulators are letting or have allowed them to do this and haven't stopped them from it. So my issue is much more with DOT and TSA than it is with any operator. I think they're trying to do business. So it's a couple quick stories on how kind of this all has gotten into my mindset. First, I don't know, a little over a year ago, a friend of mine here, I live in Dallas, a friend of mine here was raving about how he was, he's got a student in med school down at University of Texas. He was going down to Austin for a football game. He lives about 15 minutes from Love Field, and you know, he's flying an airline. Again, I'm going to end up saying an operator's name, but it's not about the operator. But anyway, in this case, it's JSX. He's flying JSX down to Austin. He can, you know, they don't want you to show up more than 20 minutes in advance because there isn't any TSA security to go through. His son sends him a text. Is he ready to go out the door 30 minutes before his scheduled departure? Says, hey, we don't have any vodka down here. Can you please bring some on your way in? And he realizes, well, I can just put it in my backpack. I have some here at the house. So he takes what he tells me. He's telling me a story. He says, I just take a handle of vodka, throw it in my backpack, go get on this airplane. And within an hour, I'm walking into my son's apartment with what he needed. To which I think, what? Wait a second. You can't do that, right? So anyway, that really was my first inclination. I knew about the airline itself. I just didn't realize things like that were being allowed. And then the second story like that is just about, I don't know, less than a month ago. Another friend of mine lives in Las Vegas and tells me how much he enjoys the service, same airline. And he mentioned, he says, well, they're actually kind of picking up the security a little bit, which I found encouraging. And then he says, I said, well, tell me more. And he said, well, for example, I make my booking online and they'd give me a boarding pass and I'd walk onto the airplane. Now they actually look at my ID. They look at my ID as I'm going on the airplane to make sure that it matches the boarding pass. To which, again, I think, holy cow. I mean, I'd heard that they check against the no-fly list for these airlines. They're required to do that by TSA. What kind of security is that? You know, if you check against the no-fly list, but then all that someone on the no-fly list needs to do is say, you know, I'm Scott McCartney, here's my birth date. Go into any college student in Austin, get yourself a fake ID that says you're Scott McCartney with that birthday with your picture on it. These aren't federal agents looking at your ID. This is, I assume, some employee of that airline. And you walk onto the airplane. Someone on the no-fly list walks onto the airplane with as much liquid as they want. That I know can happen. Much worse things can happen, but that can certainly happen. So yeah, I don't think that's what we should be doing as a country. I think it's, you know, you mentioned I was there, I was, and that's why I'm really fired up about this. You know, we talk about 9/11, we say never forget. And of course, as a country, we don't forget the event, but we've clearly forgotten all the work that has been done since the event to make sure it can never happen again. Mm-hmm. You know, right after 9/11, we set up TSA, a federal agency. Before that, you know, airlines weren't checked by federal agents. We set up a federal agency to do ID checks and things like that. Then we had a, you know, Richard Reed tried to put some explosive in his shoes so people had to take their shoes off. And we began doing that. Then we had the underwear bomber who fortunately failed, but had enough explosives packed into his underwear to blow up an airplane. And we put in place body scanners. Then, you know, some years later, there was a credible plot amongst terrorists to bring enough liquid onto airplanes that fortunately the Brits caught that stopped what they were planning to do, which they said was going to be worse than 9/11 by bringing on enough liquids to blow up airplanes. So we put in place the liquid ban. So, and these were not, those, I mean, when I say it sounds reactionary, they weren't reactionary. You know, we CEOs were all part of top secret briefings by the TSA at the time telling us, you know, that they understood that these were things that are going to be restrictions on customers, but they were really important. And they let us know that this was, you know, not just something that perhaps might happen, but things that people were actually plotting to happen. And they let us know that these terrorists have an obsession with commercial aviation. And we, you know, we worked with TSA to make sure we could put in place things that made sure our country was safe and our passengers were safe and our team was safe, because these are real issues. And they still exist, of course. So I just don't understand. you know, why we allow this to happen. But we're doing it as a country. I think it's, you know, I don't even like saying all these things out loud because it sounds, one, it sounds alarmist, but two, it also, you know, someone can interpret this as though you're telling these people what to do. Trust me, they know what to do.
Yeah.
They are terrorists. They want to do things that hurt our country. They're obsessed with commercial aviation. We put all these things in place for a reason. And now for some reason that I cannot understand, we have the agencies that are responsible for making sure this doesn't happen, letting it happen. And they've known about it long enough. You know, we talked to them about it over a year ago, and they're studying it. And again, it's irresponsible.
Great to have you back, Doug.
Hey, Ben.
We've been talking about small planes and passengers who don't connect. Isn't the argument too small to worry about?
Oh, gosh, I wish. Yeah, I mean, they're smaller airplanes, but JSX is flying Embraer 145s. Those are, you know, we had those in the fleet at American. Those are designed to be 50-seat aircraft. They weigh 50,000 pounds. They carry, you know, I don't know, something around 1,700 gallons of fuel. You take a 50,000-pound airplane with 1,500 gallons of fuel on it, you can do some serious damage, very serious damage. I mean, that's like the third of a size of an A320. And look, they you know, that airline has 45 of these airplanes. So, and it's a scheduled service airplane. So you can guarantee yourself, if you wanted to, that you can have control of 10 airplanes in the sky at one time. And again, I hate to sound so alarmist, but somebody has to, for God's sake, because this can happen. And I think it will happen if we don't close this up. So yeah, this is, they're not too small. They're not as large as the airplanes that were using 9/11, but there are a lot more of them. We've made it easier than it was back then to get control of them. And yeah, I think you can do a lot. I think you can do a lot of damage. Not to mention, and that assumes, of course, you've got control of the airplane, which hopefully can't happen with reinforced doors. But with all the things you can bring on these airplanes, I can't imagine that in some cases it's not possible to get access to the cockpit. You know, one flight attendant, you can bring on who knows what else, box cutters, et cetera, and make sure you have control and get control of an aircraft. But irrespective of that, you know, not to mention the passengers and crew that have trusted the DOT and TSA to ensure that they're safe, they're being failed.
So before we go on, I'm curious, do you get any kind of answer from TSA about why? I mean, I know they provide security at remote locations. The exclusive private terminal at LAX, for example, has TSA people go across the other side of the airport and screen people when there are people to be screened. It may not be the full rigorous, same equipment over there, but it's not high volume. They can pat somebody down. They put them through a metal detector. Is this a money issue that they don't want to send officers over to the FBO where JSX and others are operating out of at different airports, or is it a manpower issue? What do they tell you?
I don't know, Scott. I mean, really, probably worth me noting. You know, I'm not at America anymore. I'm sure people are going to look and listen to this and think this is American trying to do this. American doesn't know I'm doing this. They probably wouldn't want me to do it because they don't. They certainly wouldn't be this aggressive about their regulators publicly. But so look, I haven't. Anyway, the answer to your question is they may have told some people. I haven't asked. I don't know what the answer to that is. But you're right. That's what's so crazy about it. There's a simple solution. Just make sure, you know, you don't have to tear these airlines down. Just make certain that we figure out a way that every passenger that boards one of these airplanes goes through the same sort of, you know, the real TSA security that's required. Have federal agents there checking their IDs, making sure their IDs actually are who they say they are. Make sure you go through a body scanner. Make sure you don't have liquids on board. All the things that we do on commercial airlines, they just need to be there to do that. And then fly the model you want. Competition's great. This isn't about not wanting to compete. This is about not wanting to have another 9/11 happen.
Yeah.
And that's where we are.
I
don't know. I'll tell you this too. I mean, I keep saying DOT and TSA. I mean, DOT and more specifically FAA, for them, this is a rulemaking process that they're going through. And that unfortunately does have some long lead times on rulemaking, because there's, you know, by law, things like comment periods and things. So anyway, that process takes longer than it should, and they could expedite it more than they are. But TSA, they are granted the authority to put in place security initiatives, as they should be,
right,
they deem appropriate. And they can do something much more quickly. My understanding is they're soon to announce something. I fear it's not going to be what I just described. I fear it's not going to be, federal agents doing all the things I just said before passengers get on airplanes. So we'll still have a lot of work to do. I have no inside information on that. I just happen to know that, again, I think they've said they're looking at this closely.
Yeah.
So it seems like they're getting ready to bring something out here in the near future. And I just worry when it took this long. That has gotten politicized, and when things get politicized, they get compromised, and there should be no compromise on this.
You're right. Remember, they tried to knock down the Twin Towers in 1993 using pickup trucks loaded with explosives.
I wonder if scheduled charter passengers are paying the TSA security fee on their tickets. I mean, passengers pay for security. It's not like they're going to hit the airlines with a bill to provide the security. It seems like if everybody's paying a passenger security fee, every passenger should be secure.
Yeah. Again, another thing I don't know myself, but you're right. It's the customers pay for these federal agents in their ticket prices. The airlines are telling you they're not paying as much as it costs, but that's okay. But nonetheless, I mean, but no one can, you'll never hear a commercial airline complain about it, for goodness sakes. We know that's what is necessary, because we know what happened. And anyway, I'm just beyond frustrated by the fact that, people have forgotten.
It's interesting. All right. You mentioned the rulemaking. So big airlines are challenging scheduled charter carrier ability to hire first officers with only 250 hours. Instead of the 1500 hours that they're required. It has seemed to me that this was actually a good path for young pilots to get real experience and a paycheck before they get behind the yoke of larger airplanes. And I'm curious, you've created a really interesting nonprofit to promote training for women and minority pilots. So what's your view of the scheduled charter pilot issue?
Well, the obvious answer to that is you may be right, and that would be nice in terms of addressing a pilot shortage. But obviously, that doesn't mean we should compromise national security to help with a pilot shortage. The airlines will figure out how to address a pilot shortage, but not at this cost. It's a good way for me to point out, though. A couple of things I think have gotten into this argument that are valid, I guess, but so less significant than what I'm talking about, which is a national security issue, that it tends to get the national security issue to be lost. One of those is we already referenced, which is this looks like airlines that don't want to compete are arguing to try and take out a competitor. We can talk about that, and I don't think that's true. And the other is pilots, an argument that their pilots don't go through the same level of they don't need the same number of hours. They can fly beyond age 65. They don't need to have the same level of qualifications as do the Part 121 carriers. So, and that gets kind of thrown in as a safety issue. And I am not here to argue about that. I don't know the answer to that. We'll leave that to ALPA to go argue. But that is not my point. I suspect. That all these airlines care as much about, the safety of their team as the commercial airlines do. They make sure that the pilots that they have are well-trained and are safe. And so be it. I don't have any issue with that. Again, it's not about the carriers and about their protocols. It's about what FAA and TSA are doing here. So anyway, we got a pilot shortage, but this is much, much bigger than trying to fix that.
Doug, are big airlines using this at least partially to try to kill competitors?
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. Particularly what I just referenced. And it's really unfortunate. Look, I think these airlines have done a nice job of couching this as, you know, big, bad, large airlines want to put out this small competitor and take out competition. And that's what it's really about. Again, I know how competitive the business is. I'm not about to argue there's not some of that going on, but it just, and less about, you know, fear of competition and more about it's just not fair. We can't do this. Why can they? That some airlines are arguing for it. But, you know, is it really is it a competitive threat? I don't know. I think last year, the largest of these guys, JSX, flew something, let's say around 1 million passengers in 2023. American flies 1 million passengers in a day and a half. So that isn't, I can't imagine that they view this as some enormous competitive threat. And then that's after, whatever, 7, 8 years of operation, they've gotten to where they have a day and a half of, you know, American, Delta, United passenger counts. So I don't think anybody's sitting around at the large airlines thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to really matter to us competitively. They may be, again, upset about the fact that their customers have to go through something much different than what these customers go through. I don't care about any of that. You know, again, I have nothing to do with American anymore. I haven't for over a year. All I care about is TSA and DOT doing what they're supposed to do so that we can avoid another 9/11.
So you talked about how you became aware of this. I'm just curious why, and you also talked about TSA finally, you know, maybe getting close to doing something. But this has been going on for years. These guys have been flying from fixed-based operators without security screening for a long time. How did this come about now? What do you think brought it to the forefront?
That's a great question, Scott. I don't know. I can just tell you again my story, how I know it. I mean, yeah. I think the short answer is they just got big enough that people began to talk about it. So again, I told you, you know, the first time it really came across my radar, again, I'd heard about the airline as a competitive issue, but the first time it really resonated with me is when I heard my friend telling me he's bringing on, you know, whatever, half a gallon of vodka onto an airplane. And that's what
father of the year taking vodka to his kid, by the way.
What's that? Yeah, no kidding. He's a nice guy. He didn't do anything wrong. He's allowed to do it. He's trying to help his son. So anyway, of course, bad people can use it the wrong way, but nonetheless. Yeah. So that's when I first heard about it. That was probably a year and a half. It was football season. So I think probably a year and a half ago. It was the first time that I kind of got alerted to it. And then I'll tell you the next time, the next event that I really remember is you had an event at Duke. You had a really well done airline symposium, and I was there. Ben was there. Dave Pekoski was there. Uh-huh. And at a break, I mentioned
the head of the TSA.
Right, correct. So Administrator Pekoski's there. And by the way, as much as I'm complaining about TSA, since I've been around since it was formed, Dave Pekoski is by far the best administrator of the TSA we've ever had. He's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So I mentioned to the administrator this concern, and he, to his credit, said, I've never heard anything about it. And that was, what was that, a year ago you had that conference?
It was, a year ago in April.
Okay, so less than a year ago. And he admitted he'd never heard of it. And then, again, not that he should have. No one had truly made it. You know, they were flying under the regulations as written. It wasn't a violation of any regulation. So no one had brought it to his attention. So I guess I did. And you also had Andrew Watterson was there from Southwest, the CEO of Southwest. Uh-huh. And he heard us talk and he chimed in. And the administrator got it right away. And all he said was, look, this is the first I've heard of it. We're going to go find out. Which, you know, gave me great confidence. What I don't like is that's been almost a year. And we haven't done anything. I honestly don't know how Secretary Mayorkas, Secretary Buttigieg sleep well at night, knowing that they've known about this issue for a year now, and it still exists. God forbid something does happen before they take action. I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they can feel like they're doing their jobs, which again, both of them, I believe, are trying really hard to do their jobs. Somehow this hasn't gotten the right level of attention on the right issue. Everything you read is about big airlines trying to kill small airlines and hurt small city service, which is BS, by the way. You know, look at where these airlines fly.
Right.
Flying to New York and LA and Las Vegas and Dallas and Miami. So At any rate, thanks for letting me talk about it, because it is not getting enough voice.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important issue, and I'm glad we can highlight it.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, and just one other thing on that point, as to why it took so long. The other thing that I think was important was the SkyWest application. When that went into DOT, I think all of a sudden people started, wait a second, if SkyWest is going to do this, that means at least there's the potential for, having American Airlines, Delta Airlines, United, all of whom use SkyWest as a partner to be selling tickets this way. And anyway, so that certainly got some attention of whether they wanted to do that. One of the things I have read in some of these stories is like, well, if these big airlines want to compete, they should just start one of these up themselves. And that sounds really, really great. But I assure you, if American Airlines went to the FAA and said, hey, we would like to start an operation just like this. We have small airplanes. We're putting 30 seats on them. We're going to, we don't need TSA security. We're going to fly this, whatever, Part 135 operation, scheduled charter. There is no way in the world that would get approved. Yeah. There's no way our federal government would let people buy an American Airlines ticket and then go through security that doesn't have federal agents there doing all the things they do if you fly out of DFW. So it's not true. And because it's not true, they shouldn't allow it for anybody else. I mean, there shouldn't be a separate standard just because your name is not American Airlines that someone else can fly it. The reason they won't let American do it because they're concerned terrorists would use it. They should have the same concern immediately today.
On other topics, were you surprised that the DOJ denied the JetBlue Spirit merger after allowing much larger combinations?
Yes, Ben, I was. I continue to be surprised by these rulings. But I mean, look, it's not like they're not fighting as hard as they can. These are not just lawsuits from the DOJ. These are lawsuits that are being won. So it's surprising to me. I was completely surprised that the JetBlue American Airlines code share got rejected by a court, and somewhat less surprised, since that had already happened, somewhat less surprised about JetBlue and Spirit, but still surprising. These are two pretty small airlines, neither of whom is doing particularly well at the time, and both of whom believe that by doing this, they will be a much better force together to compete and to provide customer service. And our Justice Department chooses to sue them and they win. So I don't know. I don't know what you're supposed to do if you're JetBlue. They can't do a code share. They can't merge with Spirit. There's no way to expand in the U.S. airline system to get to the kind of scale they'd like to have. So mergers are arguably what they have to go do. They have the strength to do it. They try to do it. They try to do code shares. And the government tells him no. I'd just be, I think I can understand why Robin decided to leave. I'd be apoplectic if I was those guys. They'll be fine, of course, but that's not what these. In my view, that's not what these laws were written to do. They're written to make sure that we don't have, monopolies and things like that. There's nothing close to that. So yeah, I was surprised.
So if Frontier returns to buy Spirit at a lower price, obviously, do you think that would face the same kind of scrutiny?
Well, again, I am no, I'm always going to say it should get approved. Not always, but things like that. But I've been shocked a couple of times now. So of late.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, of course it should. And even, if you look at this ruling, at least what was said, is that the problem with JetBlue Spirit is that Spirit was they were going to take a Maverick pricer and make them less Maverick by making them JetBlue. There's no argument of that in Frontier Spirit. So anyway, I have no knowledge as to whether anybody's working on that or whether it makes sense. I certainly would. One would think that those two even smaller airlines getting together with similar business models would be something they could get through, but God, who knows?
American seems to be totally rewriting its advantage in distribution policies. Do you think this will become a trend? It reminds me of the 1990s when commissions were cut.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. It reminds me of that, too. I mean, this has been a long initiative by all airlines. American's been one of the leaders of it from back when you and I were there. And what I know is American's working really hard to encourage people to book directly on them, not just individuals, but corporations. And what I remember from when I was there, you know, that as I was toward the end of my tenure, they actually negotiated some new language into contracts with some of the large GDSs, which allows them to do things that we couldn't do in the past. So this looks to me like now with that ability, they're becoming more aggressive. And I think it makes sense for the airlines for certain to have incentives for people to come directly to them. And I suspect other airlines will do the same thing over time. They may not have the ability in their contracts just yet, but they will soon if American has it. And I suspect you'll see others do the same.
So we've seen a lot of media attention focused on sustainable aviation fuel and airlines making some sizable investments in that. But the reality is there's never going to be enough fuel to really get to the 2050 goals, at least as we're doing now. What do you think sustainable aviation fuel is a realistic industry strategy?
Well, I hope so. It's, to my knowledge, the best one available right now. Certainly under the current set of circumstances, I would agree with you. We're not going to get there because it's not commercially viable for the producers to produce sustainable aviation fuel because it's too expensive. So, I think what needs to happen is what happened with solar and wind and other new sources of energy, which is the government's subsidize to at least get it to where it's commercially viable and then let it go from there and to get enough production in place that it can be done. So that's what I think we need. I don't know that there are better ideas. I can assure you airlines aren't sitting around saying, okay, well, we know this won't work, but let's just talk about this one until we can figure out a better plan. Everyone's invested in this. As you note, airlines have made enormous investments of their own into it, but airlines can't invest enough in this for it to work. It has to be national initiatives to really improve the environment. Absent that, I don't think there will be enough. And you'll see airlines instead trying to do things like offsets, which is not it's certainly not optimal. But hopefully, real offsets like carbon recapture or things like that. But the real answer is sustainable aviation fuel. And the answer to getting it commercially viable is getting some government support.
Yep.
How are you keeping busy since stepping down as CEO? Has your golf handicap dropped a bit?
my golf handicap has not improved very much, but I'm staying busy. I'm having a great time. I'm on the board of Qantas, which is keeping me somewhat involved in the industry and gets me down to Australia several times a year. So I'm enjoying that. I'm on the board of Vanderbilt. I'm on the board of the National Medal of Honor Museum Foundation. I'm actually taking some time and being a real board member of those versus what I could do when I was working. But then mostly, and most importantly, and most of what I'm spending my time on is what Scott referenced. My wife, Gwen, and I have founded a nonprofit called Breaking Down Barriers with the mission of getting underrepresented youth, young adults to become airline pilots, letting them know that that's something they can do. These high potential kids absolutely can become pilots if they want to, letting them know it's an option. And if they want to, give them the funding they need to go become them. Those are the two biggest barriers. It's really expensive. And so underrepresented people don't have the ability to pay for the training. And frankly, they don't even know it exists. They don't know the opportunities exist. So we're going out into communities trying to find individuals. If you look at our website, there's no way to apply for one of our scholarships. If we did that, we'd have thousands of them come in. But those are all people who are aware of this circumstance. We're trying to go out and really transform communities by letting the people that are living in them understand that these are opportunities they can have if they want to. It's not easy to be a pilot. You got to be really smart. You got to be quick on your feet. You got to be able to adapt under pressure. You got to be a leader, all those things. But those people exist in these underrepresented communities, and we want to help them reach their full potential because those barriers that exist right now are stopping us from having the best of the best. If some people have barriers in their way that others don't, we're not really getting the best. So we're trying to help us get the best.
That's wonderful, Doug. I really love what you're doing with the foundation. Love talking to you. It's been a great conversation. Come back early and often. We love having you on Airlines Confidential. And thanks very much for bringing this issue to our attention. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I love talking to you guys. You guys are both good friends. I appreciate it. Good luck.
Promotional consideration provided by thearchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard thearchive.net.
Thanks again to Doug for a very interesting conversation. I hope the security issue he raises gets the thorough attention in Washington that it deserves.
Scott, I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15th in Miami Beach. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, listeners can get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we are looking forward to being part of it.
Okay, let's open up the mailbag. First, JP from Chicago writes, "Hello, Scott and Ben. Recently, American ordered 260 new narrow-body aircraft from Airbus, Boeing, and Embraer. United has ordered hundreds of new planes also. Delta has done the same. My question is related to the useful life of aircraft. How long can a commercial aircraft safely fly before being parked permanently in the desert? It seems Delta and United have some 767s and 757s that have been flying for 30-plus years. I've heard that Delta does the best job at maintaining aircraft, and the average age of their aircraft exceeds that of American and United. What best practices have they adopted on the maintenance side to keep their birds in the sky for over three decades? Also, wouldn't flying older planes with older technology eventually become a headwind to profitability?" Thanks, JP. It's an excellent question. Airplanes can fly a long time if properly maintained. In major overhauls, much of the airplane gets rebuilt, repaired parts and structures. It gets more and more expensive to maintain an older airplane, and they may become less and less reliable. Delta, really Northwest, ran DC-9s and other airplanes as long as 40 years, some even a few years longer. Delta figured that it was cheaper to incur higher maintenance costs and higher operating costs since the older planes aren't as fuel efficient than it was to spend heavily buying new airplanes. I used Cirium's fleet data and found that the average age of Delta's fleet of 946 mainline planes in service right now is 15.1 years. The oldest fleet, on average, is the A320. The youngest A320 Delta flies is 20 years old. The oldest is 33 years old. Delta also has, as you noted, 757s that are 35 years old. But Delta is clearly renewing its fleet. United actually has an older average age right now, 15.9 years. United has 767-300s, almost 33 years old. American's average age is 13.1 years, and Southwest at 11.6 years on average. And it may be worth noting that Spirit's average age is just 6.4 years. Its oldest plane is an A319 that you probably bought, Ben.
You're right, Scott, and it's even more complicated. There is an engineering answer, which you did well, and also a financial answer. Maybe the plane is on a 12-year lease and the airline chooses to replace it with a new one at the end of that lease. Change the lease term to 6 years, and you have decades of Ryanair's strategy to keep maintenance costs down. Maybe the plane can still fly safely, but the fuel and maintenance savings of the new technology make it worth buying the new replacement. There's no one right answer, and a lot goes into it. But as you implied, Scott, go to the desert with unlimited funds and some good mechanics, and you can get almost anything in the air.
The art of keeping airplanes aloft is really fascinating and very complicated, but you can keep an airplane flying a long time. Okay, question number two. Matt from Rochester, New York asked, "Hi, Ben and Scott, love the show and was wondering if you might put something together down the line on the economics of airline lounges. I understand to some extent how shared lounges work. The lounge operator is compensated by Priority Pass or whatever lounge network is being used. For large network carriers with lounge operations, it's a bit more opaque. How do they evaluate whether they are a net positive for their particular company and whether to expand or contract their lounge footprint? Thanks in advance, Matt." Well, Matt, lounges can be quite profitable, and I think you could see that with the proliferation of lounges going on right now at airports. It didn't start that way. It was all about attracting the loyalty of high-fare business travelers, but it has evolved into a profitable business. Customers pay for access, either buying an annual membership or buying a credit card that gives them lounge access. If they do it through the credit card, the bank pays the airline each time a person goes into that lounge. Make no mistake, they are expensive to run. Leasing the space is expensive, and the finish out of a lounge runs into millions of dollars. But airlines wouldn't be putting lounges all over big airports, and credit card companies like American Express and Capital One and Chase wouldn't be building their own lounges if they were all losing money on it. People love lounges, and they are paying for it.
I would note that while many lounges are now profitable, it's in part because airlines have become more restrictive about who can get in. Plus, with more credit card companies opening their own lounges, at some places there may be a capacity problem hurting the lounge profits.
Yeah, we'll see. That's a really good point. The lounge shakeout may be coming, but not this week. That's it for another episode of Airlines Confidential. Thanks to Doug Parker for an interesting talk about several important issues. And thanks to you, Ben, for taking the plunge with the new voice option. I think it's fantastic, and I'm really anxious to hear what listeners think.
And let me know if you like my new voice or if you want breathy, garbled Ben back. Have a great week.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.